yesterday at the opening, I was telling the audience that if people would actually really be here Friday, 2:30 p.m., because nobody ever shows up at the conference Friday afternoon, I said, if people would come, I would get them chocolate or something like that. So it's a Backel Mana Schnitten, and I'll hand it out to you. And you take the first one, you share it, you know, you share that whole thing. And if it's gone, it's gone. And I'm telling you, all the speakers and people who are organizing Paraflows, they don't get a single piece. So it's only for the guests. Okay. Sorry, we're closed. I called my talk today, it's kind of like the keynote, I have to say. And I thought it would be interesting to do a keynote about the conference, about open cultures, and call it Sorry We Are Closed. And I have a certain reason for that. I also have to say that I only have 2 slides in my PowerPoint presentation. Usually I have 300 or something like that. Today, no. Sorry We Are Closed. Why did I choose that? Because actually I want to talk about this. It's a vast map of interesting things and movements and groups and cultural ideas. Of course, I cannot fit all of that into a 30-minute presentation now, but I'll at least try to do that. Because nowadays, especially in our, where do we have it? Where's the peer pressure? Especially in our peer group here, we like to talk about the openness of our culture. We like to talk about how wonderful and liberal and interested we are in our diverse scenes and how we listen to each other. In fact, I think that's a little bit of a problem in itself. Because as far as I can tell in all my research in the last couple of years, the one thing that the wonderful hackspaces, the international movements for freedom of information, etc., the one thing they are not is open. And that's my rant, and I want to start this conference with a rant about the closedness of the movements and groups and ideas I encountered in the last couple of years. It doesn't really matter where to start, so I'll just pick the first one here, and that is called hackerspaces. Hackerspaces, I wrote a pamphlet together with my friend Frank A. Schneider a couple of years ago. Is first question to the audience, who knows what hackerspaces are and who has been to a hackerspace? Okay, so then let's explain to you what hackerspaces are. Hackerspaces, in fact, derive from an idea as old as the idea of communities and technology itself. The first things that we would call hackerspaces were present in the 19th century. Of course, they are not hackerspaces in the way that we think of hackerspaces nowadays, namely spaces where people can meet, learn from each other, at least that's the theory behind it. And hackerspaces exist in the meantime in many, many, many countries, in many, many towns around the globe. And the big Cambrian explosion of hackerspaces happened in the year 2006 and 2007. Before 2006, 2007, there were probably around 50 to 100 hackerspaces on planet Earth. In the meantime, it's going into 1,000, 2,000, something like that. So what happened in that time, and what is a hackerspace, and why is that so relevant for the open communities today? And why is it also interesting to take the example of the hackerspace and see why the openness of the open culture is sometimes failing in a very spectacular way? So hackerspaces, of course, exist for a long time. They get very, very interesting in the 60s and 70s, because the countercultural movements of the 60s and 70s kind of found out that we have a problem. The hippie movement realized pretty soon that it's impossible for them to change the system of capitalism from within. It doesn't work. So that's why we have many, many frustrated hippies in the 70s and 80s who kind of saw their vision of an alternative future for themselves and their children completely failing, because they thought it would be a pretty easy thing to change the system from within, it didn't work at all. The capitalist system itself is a very adaptable system. And what happened was that the system itself was actually benefiting from the hippies and the countercultural movements. There's this wonderful New Yorker cartoon from the early 1970s where you see a kind of classic dirty hippie character buying an LP from in a shop where a really tidy looking guy is handing over the LP to him, and the hippie is paying for the LP. The LP, of course, is some kind of like flower power-ish looking countercultural music kind of thing. And so he hands over, the clerk hands over the LP over the counter to the hippie. And the subtitle of the cartoon is, "This is counterculture." And that's exactly what the problem is. The capitalist system itself has one thing that is unbeatable, namely, A, it's totalitarian. There is not a single centimeter of the planet, Earth, that is non-capitalist. There is a big problem in grasping that, but wherever you go, you have states, you have state capital, and you have control over everything. So the mere idea of stepping outside the system is not really working, because there is no outside. The good thing is that the hippies and the founding moment of the punk movement kind of realized that. And they said, well, if we cannot step outside the system, if we cannot take control of what's going on and change everything, at least we kind of try to form autonomous zones in the system. So we try to punch holes into the system that are probably not real holes, but kind of like ditches. We try to create ditches in the system. The system is more like a jellyfish than a brick wall. So if we punch in a side of the jellyfish, we can probably hide somewhere in the jellyfish. And that's where the hackerspaces start. And that's also where pretty much all countercultural movements of the 70s and 80s start. They start with the idea of, let's try to find a niche in the system and make it a little bit cozy for us in our political worldviews. That's where the hackerspaces start, because the first really interesting hackerspaces were created in Germany and the Netherlands as part of the squatting movements. The squats were very much interested in and did overtake buildings that were not used and kind of illegally lived in those buildings that were usually only used for like tearing them down or using them and renovating them and selling them to renters or whatever it is. So many hackerspaces started pretty much as the technological side of the squatter movement. The squatter movement needed people who were able to fix pipes, who were able to build a new roof or change something in the roof because the water was leaking in. So all the squats had a small workshop, and it was really important because most of the time they couldn't just like call someone, could you just fix our pipes? Because of course it was illegal for people to go there and fix the pipes. They were squatting those buildings. So they had to find people who could do that themselves. So there's one root of the hackerspaces movement definitely in the need of fixing the shit that you're living in. And a couple of other roots of the hackerspaces, of course, emerge from the students' movement in the 70s and 80s, especially at technological institutes or universities like the MIT, stuff like that. The term hacking itself was derived from MIT students in the 50s who were actually pranking MIT or pranking fellow colleagues. So the term hacking itself is a non-technological term. The term of hacking means we abuse something. We take something and use it in a different way than we should do. One of the early hacks of the MIT students was taking a car and putting it on the roof of MIT. And that's actually a pretty good hack. Like, how can you do that? But they managed to do that somehow. Still, the term hacking, of course, emerges is being transformed. But in general, nowadays, there are a couple of hardcore anachronists who would say hacking only means abusing or breaking into computer system, secured computer systems. But in the meantime, I would say that 95% of the people who think of hacking think of it as a way to abuse systems or technologies, but abuse in a positive connotation. So take something and reuse it. Reverse engineering is also a classic example for that. But if reverse engineering as a term comes from engineering itself. So they, of course, as most of the computer systems they used in the USSR, they were all reverse engineered systems from the West, for example. So I'm not sure if I would call the USSR the biggest reverse engineer and hacker in the 70s and 80s, but maybe we could do that. So the hacker spaces have a clear, as I'm trying to explain, subcultural background and grew out of certain subcultures. In the year 2006, 2007, and of course 2008, there was a big boom of hacker spaces because many people could not do what they wanted to do, especially people in the technologies, because they were fired. So the big emergence, this big Cambrian explosion of hackerspaces happened because people were still interested in doing creative things with technology, but they couldn't do that in their jobs. They were kicked out by Adobe or whoever that was, because the world economy was collapsing in that time. And even before that, technological companies laid off many, many, many people. So you had people who were interested in doing interesting stuff, couldn't do that at their job anymore, or had free time because they were not working at their jobs all the time, but needed a space to go and do something. The hackerspace in Vienna, for example, the Meta Lab was started in 2007, so an early example. 2006, an early example of the classic hackerspaces. The C-Base in Berlin is 20 years older. The C-Base in Berlin works more like a mixture between a nightclub and a workshop. In Vienna, I would call it that the hackerspace MetaLab is more a mixture between a youth club and a workshop, and workshop or hackerspace. The interesting thing about hackerspaces is that all of the hackerspaces have one common ideology, and the common ideology of hackerspaces is the openness of drop by. We have machinery here. We have people who are interested in showing you and teaching you technology. And technology could be as diverse as knitting and soldering or something like that. Yeah. So it's very much a movement of, we have a space, drop by, you can hang out here, you can work, and together we'll make a better world because we are all interested in knowledge and sharing that. The problem with the hackerspaces now is that, and that's part of the problem of peer pressure, it's part of the problem society of control, and of course, problem, of course, related to elitism, which is the biggest one, I think. Hackerspaces is open communities, comparable to also the free software movement and some parts of open source. They find themselves over knowledge. If you define a community about knowing something, that knowledge that is actually the really interesting part of it, the openness of that knowledge, suddenly becomes a commodity. Because I've seen so many times, and it starts as low as that you go into a hackerspace, see a guy who wears a t-shirt with a joke on it. You do not understand the joke because it's a very encrypted, coded, geek joke, a very elitist humor most of the time. And just because you do not understand that joke, those guys wouldn't even talk to you. And that's the problem of the elitism in hackerspaces. At the same time, it's also a problem of the elitism in the open source movement. You have to have a certain knowledge, a certain mindset to actually being able to get into those so-called open communities, because those open communities would immediately reject you if they smell that you're different, which is a complete interesting phenomenon. How is the openness of a scene suddenly the problem of the scene? Because all hackerspaces, of course, would never, and there are big discussions. I led a panel discussion at the Hope Conference, which is one of the biggest hacker conferences on in the United States just 2 months ago. And the problem is that most of those people in those scenes, hackerspaces are an example in the physical world where you meet physically, but open source movements and free software movement, they sometimes don't even meet in real life. But still, there are mechanisms of sorting through people you would like in your scene and not like in your scene. That's the elitism aspect of it. So there is certainly peer pressure going on. First of all, hackerspaces and most of technological and politically interesting technological movements are highly dominated by white middle-class males. That's the first problem. You go into a hackerspace and the chances that 90% of the people in the hackerspace are white, heterosexist males is very high. Yeah. There are examples where that is not the case, but those examples are usually in places where you don't have the problem at all usually, namely San Francisco. San Francisco, Noisebridge in San Francisco is one of the few hackerspaces where they have almost a 50% male-female ratio or male-female transgender ratio, where I would like put the boundary there, I don't really know. But still, so in San Francisco, from the beginning of Noisebridge, they had a very, very clear rule that actually was enforced. And that means if someone enters the hackerspace Noisebridge, which is open, by the way, 24/7, so there is no key for Noisebridge, still to that date, I think, yes? I think there is no key. The person who is there, it's the rule, the basic rule is the person who is there. And if it's only one person, then it's only one person who can do that job. If no one is there, it is usually a bit of a problem, but whatever. If no one is there, usually people turn around and go away anyways. The problem is that entering a space that you do not know, that is common, that is uncommon for you, that is something that is not entirely self-explainable, you need a guide. You need a mentor to get into that system, especially if it's about explaining technology, if it's about what can be done here, what should not be done here. There are certain rules, and these rules start with the first rule, let's say, of Fight Club. And the first rule of the Noisebridge Fight Club is, it is your duty to talk to the people who come through the door. And it's pretty strange rule, because usually you would think an open community works in that way, that you're interested in if people come into the space and you want to talk to them and show them around and what cool stuff we have here. But usually no. Usually people sit there at their laptops or do soldering or do whatever they do, and they don't even turn around and speak to those guys. And that's the first hurdle, I would call it. The first socially awkward moment is getting into a space that you do not know. You always feel intimidated. That's a classic thing. Everyone knows that. Yeah? And how can you break that up? How can you break the moment of intimidation and open the system? Because a guy coming in, that's a really easy example. A guy coming in, seeing someone, not talking to him, he's feeling awkward anyways. He's turning around and going away. Is that what happens most of the time in hackerspaces? And that's where the step into the room is where the closedness of the scene starts. If you're not open enough to talk to the people who come through the door and tell them what's going on here, then we have a big problem. Hackerspaces deal with that problem a lot. And I'm not even yet talking about problems of that there are not too many female members in hackerspaces. How can we deal with this problem? How can we deal with the problem of that? Many hackerspaces are in very interesting areas, mostly very ethnically diverse in the States, but also in Germany. For example, the hackerspace in Cologne is in a very predominantly Turkish neighborhood because it's cheap to be there. Yeah? But they don't have a single Turkish member. So we have a problem with diversity, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But okay, I don't want to talk the whole rant about hackerspaces, but the same problem we have in hackerspaces can be copy-pasted to many, many other fields that I put here. 2600, the hacker magazine, actually have a very, very interesting way to organize their Hope conference, and also how to get more female writers to write in the Hacker Quarterly, a very, of course, strong male-dominated scene. And it's quite interesting to mention those guys as a positive force in that realm. Okay, so hackerspaces are, and that would be my next leap. How can we understand what's going on in the open culture if we don't really know what openness means? And most of the people who are interested in open culture actually live and work in environments that are pretty close, that are closed off. So the main problem is, how can you talk to someone and pretty much like criticizing their way of doing something without being the next one that is kicked out of the system? Because what systems don't like, especially elitist system, is criticizing them. So how can we socially engineer, and hackers really like social engineering, yeah? So how can we socially engineer the open culture movement in them understanding that if they call themselves open culture, they are not necessarily open? How can you explain someone that his behavior is elitistic if the last thing that guy wants to hear is that he's an elitist? Because it's against his, it's a cognitive dissonance in their field, because the last thing they want to hear is their main problem. One example is the do-it-yourself movement that's, of course, very strong in hackerspaces, but also very strong in the information activist realm, and in, of course, the open hardware realm. Open hardware is a good example where there is a good discussion going on now about the fundamental problems of open culture, especially digital culture. And I'm jumping down here to commodity fetishism. And of course, I'm jumping, where do we have it? Now let's leave it with open hardware. And materialism, there we have it. One problem of open culture and free culture, and also the open content and free media movement, is that there's one thing, and that's, as a classically taught Marxist, I really have to repeat over and over and over again, is that there is a material side to what we're doing here. There is always the basic layer of, to do all of that, you need hardware. That's why the open hardware movement is very important. At the same time, it's, of course, a problem. Because whatever we want to do, it doesn't matter if it's a Windows machine or a Linux machine or whatever it is. The hardware that we use for our cultural freedom, for our openness, for all the stuff that we want to do, that information wants to be free, that we want open data, that we want free media. But the hardware, the microphone, the processors, all of that stuff, is being built somewhere where people are the least free possible on our planet. We have an iPhone, and we use it to Twitter, to send our tweets, to have our wonderful freedom of information, our freedom of knowledge, our open culture, open source, whatever things we want to do. But all the time, and I'm very cynical now to say it that way, the whole open culture movement is always standing in blood, at least until its knees, somewhere there. Because the tools that we use, the hardware tools we use, are built on materials that are like, you know, dug out of the ground somewhere in Congo where people are dying to do that. They are made into product somewhere in China because our system just like outsources all that processes to, of course, the labor markets that are, of course, cheaper than we have it here. But how can we fix that? The open hardware movement is part of the solution. I'm not sure if it's entirely possible. Yeah? I don't want to be too pessimistic about this whole stuff, but I don't know. Being an interesting DIY guy and using Arduinos and stuff like this, of course, frees you from probably having to buy things, but it doesn't free you from buying an Arduino, because even the Arduino is made with material. Even if the chip is made in Italy, the material comes somewhere from Africa or whatever it is. So thinking about open hardware and thinking about open culture does not free us from thinking about the material ground that our culture is built on. If we have the freedom of blogging or whatever we want to do, we have to reconsider how free we are if the deep sea cables that connect us to the US to read an interesting website there about ecology and climate change or whatever it is, the deep sea cables are owned by big corporations. There is hardly a single piece of hardware on the planet that is important for our communication that is not in the hands of profit-oriented companies. And clicking through the terms of service and all that stuff of most of these companies, you get kind of like a headache reading all of that stuff. So I'm not sure. I'm not saying we should all quit Facebook now because it's such a wonderfully evil thing that they do there, when at the same moment I would have to quit pretty much everything in my life. So, like, Facebook is just the tip of the problem, yeah? And the real problem, sorry, Marxist speaking here, the real problem is who owns the means of production. And if we talk today about open culture, the means of production of open culture are not open. How can we fix that problem? I don't know. I'm just reminding you that if we are not starting to dig out our own stuff somewhere in Africa, we have a problem, yeah? Okay. So maybe I'm an elitist now because I have the luxury of reminding you of doing this and having the same problem of owning an iPhone and not knowing what else to do. Yeah, because it pretty much doesn't make a difference if I own an iPhone or if I own an Android. I mean, of course, there is the elitist discussion that the Android platform is more open than the Apple platform. And I was, yeah, okay. Then we have the internal discussion of like what's open and what's not open. But that openness, of course, is always, to quote Adorno again and again and again, the false premises. To quote Marx, we all live in a false consciousness. So, but what is the real consciousness? I don't know. It's, of course, reflected in the gratis versus libre movement, in free music. All of that stuff, of course, is interesting because it helps people, primarily in the West, to fight a good fight against the domination of cultural machines and institutions. At the same time, we cannot stop there. Just to address the privacy problem, that's, of course, ingrained in all of that. My personal belief, and that's another attack I want to ride my attack horse through town today, is that for a long time, I was a hardcore Verfechter. I think there is no better word than Verfechter in English. How do you say Verfechter in English? Defender, maybe a defender, but I think it's even more. But I was very pro-privacy, let's call it that way. Yeah? And talking to groups like Quintessence, etc., didn't make that better. The problem that and many, many people in the last that I spoke to in the last 2 or 3, 4 years that I had is that privacy, actually, from my leftist background, privacy did not exist until the Enlightenment. Privacy is a concept that is actually very bourgeois, and it's probably 200 years old, maybe 250, something like that. Privacy as a concept did not exist before that time. It is very related, of course, to having a very distinct difference between where you live and where you work, where you have your social contacts, etc. So privacy, of course, is something that we like, and it's almost, I would call it, a fantasy. There will never ever be privacy for any one of us, because our system itself is built on the exact opposite factors that would actually make privacy work. Although capital system itself and the bourgeois society created what we call privacy nowadays, there is kind of like a paradoxon going on there, that the system that created the term in itself is now actually trying to rip it apart. My personal attraction to privacy is diminishing, I would say. I'm, of course, only talking at the moment about Western liberal societies. I'm not talking about Iran or North Korea or China or something like that. I think there has to be a different discussion, what we call privacy and what use privacy should have in Western liberal societies and in classic fundamental totalitarian societies like China, semi-totalitarian, or Iran. Of course, it's very important in Iran to have privacy for people who are gay, for example, because they would simply be killed if people find out that they are gay. So there is a certain need for that kind of privacy. The question in the West is, why do we need privacy, and why are so many people so harsh about any kind of discussion that goes against privacy? So why are so many people having endless Facebook discussions about why Facebook is so bad about privacy? And that's exactly what I say is the problem, because for most of the Western people, it's a luxury discussion. It's a discussion about something that you would actually would like to have, but it doesn't make that much sense for most of the Western people to really, they never see the downside, let's call it that way. There's a really interesting fellow living in Berlin. His name is Christian Heller, Plomlompom, and he recently wrote a book that is called Post-Privacy, Prima Leben ohne Privatsphäre, so living a good life without privacy, yeah? And it's very interesting. I highly recommend all of the German-speaking people here to read this book, not because I think that all of you will accept his discourse and all of you will like what he's saying, but he's actually making a very good point. He's making the good point of, he's asking the good question of, like, why are there so many people, for example, demonstrating against the Google Street View cars in Germany? What is the problem with a car driving around, taking pictures of the outside of your building and putting that on Google? Is it really that they don't like their privacy, whatever that is, if you think about the outside of a building being invaded? Because they always play that along the side of privacy. They don't like that. Or is it simply a mechanism of trying to other a very conservative critique. The conservative critique that there are entities out there we cannot control, but at least we can make their life hard, which of course is to a certain extent the same technique that many people in the open community and in pranking cultures use. So if we cannot destroy Deutsche Bank, we can at least make their life hard by creating fake Deutsche Bank home pages and something like that. The question is always, how does that work and how does that help? So does it really, is it really bad for Google to have, I don't know, like 1,000 people in Germany going on the street or not on the street and stopping Google to take images of their houses and putting that off their website? Who is actually helping that? It's helping, of course, a public discourse about Google and what Google is doing. At the same time, most of that discourse is very conservative. It's a very conservative critique of the capitalist system that is always, and that's the main problem, differentiating between the good capitalists and the bad capitalists. Google are the bad capitalists because they are so big and they control so much. The good capitalists like the Deutsche Telekom or something like that, well, nobody's complaining about what Deutsche Telekom is doing, and that they're actually supporting way more horrible things in Germany. But because Google is visible and because Google is such an easy target to attack, that's why they take Google and attack Google. But that's only like a top 10 why picking Google? Of course, they pick Google because Google is visible. And because you can make a point, but the question is that changing anything? An example for that is one thing that I always like to take is that we have a problem going on right now between the society of the disciple, the disciplinary society, and the society of control. That's pretty much what it's all coming back to. We live in a society where the hierarchies are getting lower and lower and lower, but still nothing ever changes. The good examples of IKEA, sometimes IBM and other corporations, where at least in the German-speaking world, it's a good example, is where the people working for these companies have a mandatory, they have to use the informal way of greeting people and talking to people in their businesses in German. In German, there's the D-form and the du-form and the C-form. Yeah, many corporations nowadays enforce the informal way of talking to their employers and employees because the du-form, so the informal way of talking to people, is actually minimizing resistance. Because if you're on a verbal level, the friend of your boss, the boss can ask you for more stuff. It's very easy in such a relationship that you're being tricked into doing things you do not want to do just because you have the feeling that your workplace, all the guys there, including your boss, are your friends. Of course, they are not. So that's what's called the society of control. In the disciplinary society, it was very clear who is your boss, and it was enforced that the guy is your boss because it was clear that you have to obey that boss. Nowadays, the system is a little bit more tricky. The boss has the same function, but the boss is your friend. And that's a problem that many, many, many people in these scenes have, that just because people seem cool doesn't mean that they are cool. And just because people seem to be uncool doesn't make them less cool than other people. There is no big difference in any way between Google, for example, and Apple. There is no big difference. There is no big difference between Google, Apple, and Microsoft. Yeah, all these entities have a clear defined goal, and they are playing that goal. Yeah, picking out some of them and nailing them onto the pranger, putting them onto the medial Dorfplatz, village square, and laugh at them and criticize them is kind of like tickling them. The thing that should be criticized about these companies are not that they want to make money and they want to secure their turf. That's what all of them are doing. Yeah, some of them do it in a less aggressive way, but in a general sense, if you read the terms of service of all the major corporations that you ever had a business relationship with, and I'm also talking about Procter and Gamble and not only Apple. Yeah. Go to the Procter and Gamble website and read a bit there what their business statements are and what they're doing. What the fuck? There would be an outcry what Procter & Gamble is doing It's way, way more interesting and way more horrible than anything that that Apple could ever write in their terms of service. Anyhow, the problem is society of control is tricking us all into believing, at least in the Western liberal societies, that we are very free and we can do whatever we like. We can go outside, do our flash mobs on the square, blah, 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 play along with the public spaces. At the same time, most of these things are always ingrained into hidden agendas. And the interesting aspect is trying to find out what the hidden agenda is beyond that corporations want to make money. That's actually a very low level of criticizing those people. An example, a classic example of the society of control is gamification. You've heard about gamification. We have a whole talk about gamification, I think, tomorrow. So I'm only going in minor details here, but a good example of gamification is here at the local Billas. Billa is a local supermarket, and they have the wonderful gamification going on that if you find a product that is beyond the due date, and you bring it to the cashier and say, hey, this milk is beyond the due date, then you get actually a new pack of milk and a second pack of milk. So you get out of the Billa with two packs of milk. And of course, people like that. People play that. Many old people have nothing better to do than to go around and do that. What they are actually doing is, by doing this, they are saving a person working at Billa. At least one person does not need to be hired by Billa because we, according to this like little gamification plan, make the job, like we do the job for that person. So Billa succeeded in a very interesting gamification campaign that nobody would call gamification and reduced the workforce by one per Billa. And if you, like, I'm not even talking about Foursquare. Foursquare should be called Feudal Square because it's about claiming land. You cannot charge, like, because feudalism was based on land. Capitalism is based on capital, of course. Feudalism was based on land, who has control over land. So I found it always quite interesting that Foursquare is taking the feudal system into the digital realm, and you can battle over who owns, who is the mayor of the Billa, of the museum's quarter, of whatever that is. Yeah, all of that stuff, of course, is generating data for the corporations that they can sell. And they're making their money. Cultural environmentalism is an interesting term. Not too many people know it. Check it out on Wikipedia, I have to say. That's a quite interesting aspect, because in the 1980s, Adbusters and those anti-corporational movements were criticizing that the environment needs to be protected. But culture is also part of environment. I'm a very constructivist person. I think there is no environment beyond what we project onto that environment. So cultural environmentalism is a thing that will be a very growing, interesting force of critique in the future. And of course, the cypherpunk discussion goes into a similar direction, because in the last 2 or 3 years, so many people discuss what's going on with WikiLeaks, with Julian Assange, and connect that actually to hacktivism, which is not really true. Cypherpunks are actually a sidetrack of the crypto anarchist movement. And the problem of that movement is that you, of course, have to link it to libertarianism and property, because the main problem we have with all the cypherpunks and the crypto anarchists is that they're actually not anarchists, they're libertarians, and fear the libertarian, I tell you. Fear it as the devil. Libertarianism kind of overtook the discourse about cryptography. And Julian Assange is a really interesting member of the species of crypto libertarianism. And what he is talking about property in his interviews, I just want to vomit, okay? So Julian Assange has a very dark side, and I'm not even talking that he doesn't like condoms, okay? the dark side of Julian Assange is that he kind of, with WikiLeaks and his libertarian worldview, occupied the whole movement. And it's kind of like, I think there has to be a really decisive re-education of cypherpunks going on, because they're all infested by the basic libertarian worldviews that made our life very, very hard in the last 20 or 30 years with neoliberalism, because just like sticking out the sign and saying we need the freedom of information, we need freedom, 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 does not save anything if you don't have a discourse about what freedom is. So I think I'll close now here. If we talk about open culture, we have to at the same time talk about closed culture, because the very definition of something open opens up the definition of that something is closed. So there is always a relation between something open, and the louder people proclaim that something is open, the more closely you have to look what's closing because of that openness. And of course I like freedom. Freedom is a wonderful concept. But freedom, we have this monochrome t-shirt, freedom is a whore of a word. Be careful when you use freedom and why you use it, because it's such a diverse, it's like a minefield. Just dropping the F word, the freedom word, opens up a whole discourse about what it actually means, and maybe that actually this discourse should be done in the future. So whenever you meet someone who likes WikiLeaks, ask them what that person thinks freedom is. And that might actually be a good discussion. Okay, thanks a lot. That was my rant.